Chazal tell us that Yudola Malugma, Shemakarebes, Yisrael, Davim Shemashamayim, great is a good meal, great is good food, because it brings Jews close to their Father in heaven. So if you have a good meal, and you're getting salami, and you're getting other tasty foods, and you don't really need me here anymore. That's enough to be Makarevis, you Lavi and Shemeshamai. Just at the time when the Jews were at seat of Mount Sinai, Har Sinai, and this is the week of Har Sinai, because we have, of course, the Parsha Yisro, and I'm going to speak a little about it. So we say that by Yechetzu Es Elokim, we don't say it in Yisro, this person you don't find in Yisro, we'll find it later, but it describes it, the scene. By Yechetzu Es Elokim, they saw Hashem, by Yochlu by Yishtu, and they ate and drank. You see, there's a relationship between eating and drinking. One would think that you first eat and drink, and then it's Makarevis. But another thing is that after you see Hashem, you have to be raised to a higher level, or a level of elation and exaltation that brings you to eat, especially Shevet Sachem Kam Yochai. This week we're going to read the Aseret Divros. There's been no proclamation in the history of the world that's had so much impact upon so many millions and billions of people as the Aseret Divros. The title of the short discussion here, and I hope to challenge you and ask for your take on this, because it's one of the most difficult things for me to understand. And I really never understood it fully, and I'll tell you how I try to explain it to myself. On the eve of the Civil War, when the nation was very sharply, and as it proved to be irreconcilably, divided, there was an Orthodox rabbi in New York, and his name was Morris Raphael. Morris Raphael originally was born in Stockholm. His father was a businessman. His father then moved to parts of Germany so that his boy would get a good education, a good Jewish education. In the end, he got a PhD as well at the University of Erlangen in Germany. He came to England. He mastered the English language. He knew English fluently. He knew French fluently. He knew German fluently, in addition to Hebrew and sundry other languages. He became the chief advisor and secretary of the chief rabbi of Israel. And ultimately, he became himself a rabbi and was the rabbi of a very important community. Ultimately, and I don't know the reason for it, he left that community after a number of years with his family. I think it was because of ill health. He suffered from ill health for a long time. He came to America and became the rabbi in what is one of the most prestigious temples, so to speak. It's not a shul in the sense of our shul, but it was at that time an Orthodox shul called B'nai Jeshurun on 79th Street. At that time it was on Green Street, what was the east side, nearer to the east side. It's not really the part of the east side as we know the east side. And the nation was moving to civil war. In November 1860, Abraham Lincoln was elected president. He did not take office until March of 1961. So there was more than it was about a 4-month hiatus between the time that Lincoln was elected and the time they took office. And those 4 months were very, very important. Important interval that led to the Civil War. It didn't lead to the Civil War, but it was a pathway, very quick pathway. Lincoln's election frightened the South because he had taken positions, not the position that he was going to free the slave. He never said he was going to free the slaves. He just wasn't going to let the slave institution grow greater in other states. And that was a real big argument that he had before with Douglas. You know anything about American history, Senator Douglas. And Morris Raphael delivered 3 drushes to his congregation on the impending Civil War, begging the nation, and at that time, this is the way he speaks like he's speaking to the whole nation, and in the end, he did end up speaking to a large part of the nation. But how can you go to Civil War and have brothers kill brother in order to abolish an institution that from the point of view of the Torah was not sinful and was accepted by it? Now, I'm just going to say what his position was. It was a very strong position. The 4 drushes he delivered, I'm not sure if he delivered it in the English language to begin with, or not, he probably did, made such an impress upon his congregation, and those people who heard about it, that it ultimately was published. And it was published in January of 1961, 3 months before Lincoln became president. 2 months. What? I mean 1861. 2 months before Lincoln became president. And in the 2 months before the Civil War, 3 months, because then Sumter happened in April, in those 3 months, that document, it was made into a pamphlet of about 50 pages. It was called A Bible View of Slavery, 3 discourses, was distributed to over 250,000 Southerners. It was the most widely disseminated document before the Civil War. Can you imagine an Orthodox rabbi? And it was read by everybody in the South. They sold about 280,000 in a period of several months, 2 months. It's unbelievable. You just take the numbers. You take the numbers today, Bert, the only one that I know could do better is probably, what's the name of that new book coming out? The 7th one? What?
Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling.
I think that they're right. Harry Potter. I don't know what it's about, but I heard it. And if I were to ask you, where would you find the most emphatic sanction for slavery in the Torah? I never thought of it until I read his thing. But I know that you must be, some of you at least, it must be so brilliant that you'll probably get it yourselves. And you have a hint because I picked it this week. I didn't pick it, they picked me, but it ended up this week in Parshas Yisro. Where do you think you'll find it? It's such a novel approach. It's really almost a Lumdish approach to this. You have here Mara McComas.
First page on the bottom.
This is it?
Yeah.
Okay. So where's the first puzzle?
This is it.
No, I need the first puzzle. Okay, good. So let's start reading the Aseret HaDibros. Before I go into the Aseret HaDibros, I just wanted to tell you, there was another rabbi who was not an Orthodox rabbi. He was in between. He already allowed reform into his career. He was not reform as we understand it. It was much better than most conservative synagogues today. It was still largely Orthodox. It was still separation of men and women. He didn't allow an organ into it. His name was Robert, was Zold, S-Z-O-L-D. Does that name Zold mean anything to anybody here except for Rabbi Joshua Hoffman, and I take it for you too? Huh? What? S-Z-O-L-D. Does that name mean anything to anybody? one of the great Jewish names and great Jewish personalities in America was Henrietta Zold. Who was Henrietta Zold? Is there one person here who ever heard of Henrietta Zold?
I heard the name, I don't remember.
Henrietta Zold was this great Zionist. And the youth Aliyah of the first, when Hitler came in, she saved thousands of Jews. She created the Hadassah, which was the largest Zionist organization in the world. And she created the Hadassah Hospital, which is the largest Jewish hospital in the world. She never got married. She was a great scholar in her own right. And her father was a rabbi in Baltimore. And even as Rabbi Rafal was praised and hailed by people in New York, New York, even though it was all the way up north, was really very much sympathetic, a great part of New York, with the Southern cause. And in fact, there was a little revolution in New York in 1863. People didn't want to go to war like in Vietnam and maybe the start in Iraq in this way. They didn't want to go to civil war. They didn't want to die for this. This is up in New York. And Henrietta Zold was put on a wagon with his family and all his belongings and driven out of town, ridden out of town in Baltimore. Because he raised the issue. He says, slavery is an abhorrent institution. He was really right. And we can't allow it. And they almost killed him and lynched him. So you have this contrast. It's very interesting and maybe a little frightening. The Aseres HaDibros. So first of all, you hear about slavery right away. Anochi.
Next page.
I see what happens. You're going upside down. This is an upside down. I'm not used to it. But okay. Anochi ad Hashem Elokecha asher hoceicha me'eretz Mitzrayim mi'beis avotim. So here we go out of the house of slavery. We were oppressed for 210 years, maybe for 400 if you consider the time the Jews spent even before they were formally oppressed.
It's on the bottom of page 2.
Weird.
For these, I made shrinking.
Oh.
For the shrunken edition, the bottom is the first page.
So what do I do? Where is the next one?
You got it.
Mi beis avodim. Then this begins in the middle.
That's the next thing.
But that's not the next thing. That's the next thing.
It's Yud. This one is Yud.
Okay. We'll go to Yud. The commandment of the Shabbos. The Yom HaShvi, Shabbos LaHashem Elokecha, Lo Sasecho Melocha, Ato, Uvincho, Uvitecho, Avdecho, Vamoscho, Vemhemtecho, Emtecho, Vigerecho, Asher Vishorecho. So he says, and here you have in the commandment of Shabbos in one of the Aseres HaDibros, the most in many ways most important in the Aseres HaDibros, next to the belief in God, Shabbos, that everybody has to rest in Shabbos. You have to rest, your son has to rest, your daughter has to rest, your slave has to rest, and your maidservant has to rest. So this seems to be a sanction for slavery. Now you don't think of it. You say, where's the pasuk say you're allowed to have slavery? It doesn't say English. But in the Aseres HaDibros, right, which is the most important document we have, it says suddenly that you have slaves. It's taken for a given that you have slaves. In no places it's considered to be an abhorrent institution. And not only do you find it once in the Aseres HaDibros, you find it later on again. In the last of the Aseres HaDibros. Yudalit. First, lo sachmo beis reyecha. Don't envy or covet the house of your fellow. Lo sachmo eishes reyecha. Don't covet his wife. V'avdo v'amaso. V'shoro v'chamoro v'chalashol reyecha. So it's just as simple as just you have in the agrarian societies today, and then certainly everybody hundreds of years ago and thousands of years ago, they had oxen, they had mules, donkeys, whatever they had. And they had Va'abdo Va'amoso. Again, so you have two of the Aseres HaDibros that take it for granted, and it's altogether natural. Like for a farmer to have a cow, it's natural for him to have a slave and to have a maidservant. So this is the way he began. Now here we're talking about really a Nebuchadnezzar. I'm not talking about a Jewish slave. Next week we're going to learn the first thing after we get the Aseres HaDibros, we begin all the commandments. We begin to the mitzvahs. What is the first mitzvah in Mishpatim talk to?
Eved Ibri.
It's talking about slavery. So you can't find a better thing to talk about than slavery. But you begin, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. V'ahavta said Hashem Elokeinu. The very first law is the law of how you should deal with slavery. Not that you can't deal with slavery. Of course, there it's not talking about Eved Knani. It's talking about Eved Ibri. So, this is the conundrum, the real problem that we have. Because I can't believe that we are now less progressive than the societies which had slaves. I just can't accept it. I can't accept it that an oppressive institution, such as slavery, is almost a summa bonum, the height of society, that is recognized and incorporated, not in the assertion, but in the just absolutely natural way of its acceptance in the Aseres HaDibros. So I want to just begin to give you some feelings that I have about this. And then I want to hear what you have to say. There is a profound difference between the slavery that cut America in half and led to the deadliest war, including, when you include even the First World War and the Second World War, the deadliest war that Americans participated in. Hundreds of thousands of Americans died. Brother killed brother. Families were divided. And more than, and I don't remember exactly, it could be more than all the wars together died in this war. It's a civil war where one American killed another one. Because it was such a dastard institution. And how could it be such a terrible institution? The Torah seems to accept it. You have all kinds of rules. And I find it probably in many ways the most difficult aspect. If you're living in a modern society, they accept it. But I think there are several answers. Maybe not full answers. Maybe they won't satisfy you. In totality, you may have better answers. And that's what I want to look for. I'm looking here for answers. I'm not looking to tell you something. I'm looking to get something. One thing is the difference between the slavery that existed in America and the slavery that existed throughout the history of the world. And he says, Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, we talk about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham had slaves. Yitzhak had slaves. Yaakov had slaves. Everybody had slaves. And Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, they're the foundation stones. And he brings this and he spells it out. He spells it out very eloquently. And suddenly we're going to say that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was something wrong with him. They had slaves. He never once remonstrated with them about this. He chastised them when he had to. He rebuked them when he had to. And they all had slaves. Of course, you know that in the history of the world, until very recently, slavery was a very common institution. You had slavery in Athens, which is the incubus of democracy in the world. You had slavery in Rome. You had slavery everywhere. But there was a profound difference between the slavery in America and the slavery. And you had slavery in Africa before there was ever an American continent. You had a greater institution of slavery. It was more pervasive and widespread there than it was in America. But what's the difference? The difference is that the slavery all over the world did not stamp any group as inferior. Any group left in it. The slaves in Greece and in Rome and all through the slaves in Spain, where they were, every nation had it. They were white people. They were white people. The slaves were white people. If there was a war between one country and another, there was a war between Israel and Canaan, Yerushalayim, and the Gibbonim, whatever it was, and the Gibbonim came later, it was really no war, and they became slaves. If we would lose a war, then the Jews became slaves. It wasn't that there was anything inherently wrong. There was no difference between the king and the slave. It was just, this was his goal. This was his fortune. Some was a king, and sometimes a slave became a king. And sometimes the king became a slave. He was over there. But there was no actually racial connotation, meaning in this. What happened here was, we took a people, we took the black people, and we suddenly said, they are inferior. It's not that they happen to be slaves. But they are inferior. They're the only ones we can take as slaves. We can't take anybody else as a slave. And they also pinioned it on the Bible, on Torah. Where do we have such an idea? Yes?
Canaan is cursed. He will be a slave of slaves to his brothers.
That's Chum. So they said that the Chum, they claim, came from Africa, which he did. He, historically, apparently, according to the way we look at history, they went to Africa. And these must be the descendants of Chum. And if these are the descendants of Chum, so they've been cursed, and therefore have these slaves. It's very difficult for us to accept an idea like that. Now, is there anything wrong with that idea? Anyone want to venture a guess? Yes.
It's a prophecy more than a mandate. It's not asking you to do anything to those people.
First of all, in a way, that's a very good answer you're giving, that there's no sanction for me to take a slave and do it. There's institutions. I don't have to take slaves. The Torah doesn't bid me to take a slave, even during war. And there may have been good reasons, because in those days, every victor in triumph would take slaves. And if you didn't take slaves, you'd be a perfect enemy. Because you'd say, look, the worst thing is can happen, we can lose the war, and we go home. That was really maybe the real understanding of slavery. But there's more than that. And so what did you say again? Repeat it.
I said it's a prophecy more than a mandate. You don't have to actually go...
Where do you have such a prophecy?
Well,
maybe... I don't mean you have this prophecy. Where do you have it? What you said is a very good answer. It was not the answer I was going to give. Okay. It may be a better answer than I was going to give. And for that alone, just to hear your answer is enough. Now the prophets came along and they told Bnei Yisrael, if Bnei Yisrael is not going to behave properly, they're going to be enslaved, they're going to be oppressed, they're going to be driven out of the land. So Nebuchadnezzar came and he drove them out of the land. Why blame Nebuchadnezzar? Chazal speaker, why blame them? They were merely fulfilling the wish of Hashem. Hashem told them, if Bnei Yisrael are not going to shape up, they're going to ship out. And that's exactly what happened. So that's one answer. So your answer is an answer. But so what is the answer? Chazal said, but nobody told Nebuchadnezzar, nobody told Haman that you can do it. They gave you a prophecy, this is going to happen, but it didn't give you a sanction to go ahead and do it. You were the Russia for doing it. So even if there would have been a curse, but I didn't give that kind of an answer. I gave, I think, a more sweeping answer, but I'm not sure better than yours. Does anybody want to venture another guess? The answer is that today we don't... Descendancy is not... Except for Bnei Yisrael, there is no such thing as descendancy anymore. We don't have a molech. It's Zohar and Masha also l'cha a molech. Mocho timcha a zecher or a zecher a molech. You have to wipe them and face them, wipe them off the face of the earth or face them entirely from your memory. And the fact of the matter is that we don't do that today. We could say Hitler, Yamach Shemo Zichro, he was all that the Amalek was touted to be, and worse. But we couldn't say he was Amalek. We could feel he was Amalek. And if we did anything to him, we had a right to, because he killed you. He says, he's Chayav Misa, or anyone comes to you, Abala Argacha, Ashkeim Baha, they get up and kill him. But there are no descendancies today among the Gentiles. There's no more Ammon and Moab. There's no more Mitzri. They have to wait three generations. All these laws are now no longer in effect. Because we don't have any sure lines among the Goyim. There was the Bilbul Ha'amim. So the same thing really applies to the Chum as well. Is there any other, anybody else want to say something? Now I wanted to tell you something else. It has to do with American history, it has to do with what we did. And I felt it for the first time, and then I found that I really, what I was saying is in the Sifsei Chachamim, but I came to it in a different way. I think so. Go to the next page. Are you a lefty? Are you? No? Okay. Now you begin Pasuk Dalet, where it says Shmos Yud Aleph, Parshas Bo. Pasuk Dalet. Vayomer Moshe, and Moses said, Ko Omar Hashem, Kachatzos Halayla, approximately at midnight, Ani Yotze B'Soch Mitzrayim. I'll go into the midst of Mitzrayim. This is what Moshe tells the Jewish people that Hashem told him. Umeis Kol B'Chor Paro, and every firstborn of Pharaoh will die. I'm sorry.
The next page.
See, that's crazy. Okay. Umeis kol b'chor b'eretz Mitzrayim, b'chor paro ha'yoshev al kiso, ad b'chor ha'shivcho asher acher v'rachayim. And then Hashem will smite and will kill every b'chor from the b'chor of paro, from Pharaoh's firstborn, from Paro who sits on the throne, until the firstborn of the maidservant, Asher Acher Chaim, who works and stands behind the grindstone. You see that? Now let's go back to just the previous page we did, and look at the Rashi over here. This Rashi is a very well known thing. Hey, Ad Bechor Hashvi, until the firstborn who's taken captivity, living in the dungeons. And then Rashi is Loma Laku Hashvuyim. Why were the captives punished? After all, the captives didn't persecute the Jews. G'day shelo yomru yirasam tova elbona. We shouldn't say that their God saved them and took their part. Ve'evi puronios al Mitzrayim, and brought great travail and troubles upon the Egyptians. Now, first of all, I want you to know, what's wrong with this Rashi? Grossly wrong with this Rashi. Anybody who gets the answer, look at you, another piece of cake. Do you have any more cake over there?
Yeah.
I didn't have any cake. I just want to take it. Bring it over. By the time you'll answer, I'll eat the whole pipe. No, okay. What's wrong with this? Is there anywhere in the pasuk? You see the Dibur HaMatzah Hey Ad Bechor HaShvi. Where is that pasuk here at all? Those words appear at all? Huh? Abba Harshvi. So what does Rashi bring here, Abba Harshvi? And then, later on, look at the next Rashi. Turn the page. Next Rashi. Mibchor Paro at Bechor HaShivra. That's the pasuk. So what does he bring this pasuk here for? Where do you find a Rashi like that? He changes the words in the pasuk. This pasuk is found 30 psukim later, approximately. Turn to the next page. This was the prophecy. The warning. Moshe tells Paro, and he tells Israel, this is what's going to happen. So he's prophesying, this is what's going to happen. Hashem told him. And go on the next page. Ko Omar Hashem, Kachatzos Halayla, and Yosef Esoch Mitzrayim. We did this already. What are you, no, you went to Yud Aleph again. What are you doing? Ah, okay. Yud Beis, the next puzzle, right? Reish Lamed Ches. Tej Reish Lamed Ches. So here you have it. 29 psukim in Yud Beis, and we were in Yud Aleph before. So it's over 30 psukim later. Vayehi b'chatzi halayla v'reshem hikor kol b'chor b'eretz Mitzrayim v'b'chor b'paro ha'yoshev al-kiso Ad Bechor HaShvi. Where do you find it? 30 psukim later. And Rashi takes that before he even says Ad Bechor HaShivcha. But Hashem, he called Bechor, I'm trying, Bechor HaParah Yoshev HaKiso, Ad Bechor HaShvi, Hashem Beis HaBor, that's in the dungeon, in the pit. Bechor Bechor Behema. So why does Rashi come here 30 psukim before? And he tells us what it means, Kol B'chor Shvi. He should have said it here. Is there another page here? No, okay. Does anybody want to tell, that's your guess, probably you heard it, you knew what it's up when you were Mavis Sedrish, Nine Mikro, Echatag. So Rashi, when he does it, you have to see, you have to read that whole Rashi we talked to you before about, that didn't belong here, and he felt that he had to bring it here, and he brought it with the Dibur HaMashal, even the Dibur HaMashal in dark letters is there. Ad Bechor HaShvi, the first question he says is, the first thing he says, that well, he's asking this question, he said the reason he mentions it is to tell us why, we have to explain why they were killed too. We don't even know they were killed yet. We don't know, it's the first time we hear about it. We haven't heard about it yet in the Chumash. He said that later on he's going to kill them, and he had to kill them even though they weren't really guilty. Only the Bechor HaShivcha was guilty. He had to kill them because otherwise Paro would say it wasn't the Jewish God that saved them, it was the God of the Shvi that saved them. Now what did, so why did Rashi have to come right here and say it? It's a very interesting Rashi. And the way that all the Mefarshim, you look at the Reim, the Yom Mizrachi, you look at the Maral Prague, they all have different answers in this. The Zizek Chachamim gives an answer that, and it was a strange answer, unless you know it. And then you see that he says it and stuff, and I didn't know he said it in the Zizek Chachamim, because the Ikas of them can't see it. And he says, because Rashi wants to prevent us from thinking even for a moment that Moshe was not telling the full truth, or he was badoi, he was a fool. He fooled us. He said before, he prophesied that they were going to kill the firstborn of the maidservants, And what happened at the end? He didn't kill the firstborn of the maidservant. He also killed the firstborn of the people who, of the women who were taken captive. So Moshe didn't know exactly what he was saying. So therefore, Rashi said, I'm not going to wait until they come there, because people remember maybe from last year. Maybe they learned somewhere. If they remember from last year what it says in Chumash, that it was the firstborn of the Shevi, maybe they didn't know it the first year they learned it, but the second year they learned it. Hey, well, how come it's this? It's not Bechor Behemah, Bechor Shifcha. It's really the firstborn of the Shevi, which was even a lower category in the caste system of Egypt and the world at that time. So what? We'll learn it later. We'll learn it when we get to it. We'll say it again. We'll explain to it. We'll know then. So I think that the answer is, and that's really, I found that the Chum gave, and I didn't know that at the beginning. There's another thing that ties together this part of the Torah, which is the prophecy of the Makas Bechoros, that the plague of the firstborn, that God will smite all the firstborn, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne until the firstborn of the maidservant. And again, and when it happens, the Torah repeats it, except there it changes the language. The firstborn of the maidservant is the firstborn of the captive. So there is a discrepancy between the prophecy and what happened. So some people will say that Moshe is Badoy. Well, what is another thing that ties together this parsha and the other parsha? I'm going to read to you the parsha closely. Again, listen to it. Ko Omar at Hashem. Kachatzos halalo ani yotze besoch mitzray. Umeis ko b'chor b'eretz mitzrayim b'chor b'haro ha-yoshev al-kiso ad b'chor ha-shifcha asher achar rachayim b'chor b'chor b'hema. And then he says, Ko Omar at Hashem. See, left out. You made the wrong pasuk. You did that. He went to Yudav, Shibin, Yud Bezev. Kol Omar Hashem, Bachatzo Salayla. Ani Yotze. What was it? You don't have it here. You can't. You see, you did it twice here. This should not, does he got the wrong? Does anybody have a chumash here? Get me a chumash. That's it. So here is a place where they said that Moshe said Kachatzos. Every reason, why did they say Kachatzos? It really happened exactly. When Hashem does it, he does it exactly. He's precisely. Man could be off a second so. That's why we maybe have Ben Hashmashas. We don't know exactly the moment when Shabbos comes in. And then we have Kotuyer and Tosas Shabbos. Tosas Yom Tov. But how come that Moshe says Kachatzos? So Chazal tell us that Moshe says Kachatzos because he was afraid later on it would seem, you know, people would have, what are the best watches? A Piaget, Wittenauer, I don't know, what are the best watches today? You pay $500,000, $1,000, $10,000 for Picard. I mean, they're different watches, but they're really off. Each one is off. You take 10 Picards, you'll find the one's off of a second ear. If Moshe was off 1 second, he's not God, then God didn't do it. It couldn't have been God, because God can't be off 1 second. See, he had to be careful and say Kachatzos. He was afraid that he'd be caught even by a second. 5 seconds certainly would have been exactly. So therefore, when it happened, the Torah tells us it was Bachatzos. So we see these two parshios are linked together by the extraordinary care that Moshe takes not to be, have the semblance of not telling, of not being perfectly honest. And most people wouldn't even have caught this discrepancy if there would have been a discrepancy. He says, Kachatzos. Approximately midnight. And then it says God came midnight. So we know that here Moshe was concerned with his reputation, the reputation of what he's doing. So it's precisely here in this parsha that Rashi feels the need to come along and say that the Bechor Paro, Ad Bechor Shvi, he's telling us immediately, I have to start over here. Moshe was concerned over here about not to be considered a liar later on. Now what does that have to do with my discussion at before? There was an American politician after the Civil War. He later became the Senator of Georgia. His name was Tom Watson. Did anybody ever hear of Tom Watson? Except for Joshua and for you. Huh? What? I have to answer quickly. Tom Watson, after the Civil War, he believed a great deal in Reconstruction, and he wanted to bring together the white and the black people. And he said the best place to start would bring together the white trash, the ones who were the lowest level of society, and the black former slave owner. And together, they would form a very powerful bloc. They would be voting. And in the South, it would be very important, because in the South, white men who were involved in the Confederation, in the Confederacy, could not vote for a period of time. And therefore, there were many black senators who came in into the... We don't even realize this history. There were black senators in the United States Senate right after that. And he said, imagine if we could unite all the white, all the people who were at the lowest strata of society throughout the United States, and they would join with all the black people, you'd have a very powerful bloc. And it failed. You know why it failed? Because as low as the white strata was, it didn't make any more money than the black person. And they were in their own way, but everybody looked at them, but they were still a notch above the black man. The black man to them was inherently inferior. The white man is not. This is the state of the white man. He didn't make it. Some of us made it, and some of us didn't make it. But like he is in Selim Elokim entirely, and therefore, and I have that one thing. They lived in the same hovels. They were just as oppressed as the others. They refused to join us because of that. You have this over here too. You have, we thought we came to the lowest level of society. The lowest level was the Bechor Shifcha. And then we're told, you know what, there was even a lower level. But they didn't come together. That low, originally the Torah doesn't tell us he's going to kill us, that low, because they didn't deserve to be killed. But there was a lower level in that, and that lower level was punished because somehow they must have felt, even if they didn't do anything against B'nai Yisrael, but they must have felt as low as we are even lower than the Bechor Shifcha. We have Bechor Shifcha. But there's still somebody lower than us. And that was a slave, Am Yisrael. So that little, almost imperceptible difference between them.